Nobody listened to her. Nobody believed her. She went to the emergency department several times, but there were places where we could have actually intervened to save her life. And she died 10 days after her C-section. So the reason that Black and Brown people are more likely to die during pregnancy and childbirth, it doesn't have to do with anything clinically wrong with Black people. It actually really has to do with the constellation and the environments in which we are seeking care.
Welcome to The Other 80. I'm Claudia Williams. When guests on the show list examples of how America is failing to support health or improve health equity, one topic is always at the top of the list: maternal mortality. And here's what you need to know about the maternal mortality crisis in this country. One, the U.S. has the highest rate of maternal mortality in the entire industrialized world. Two, that rate is 3 to 4 times higher if you're Black. Three, it's getting worse. Between 2021 and 2022, the number of maternal deaths went up by a shocking 40%. But lastly, and most importantly, these deaths are preventable. Dr. Monica McLemore is an anti-racist birth equity scholar who spent 28 years in clinical practice as a nurse and is now a professor at the University of Washington School of Nursing. In this conversation, we discuss what's driving the high rate and incredible increase in maternal deaths in the U.S. and what a national prevention agenda would look like to turn those trends around. So please welcome Monica McLemore to The Other 80. Welcome to the show, Monica. It's great to have you on, and it's been a minute since we saw each other. I think we met and had great interactions when I was working at the White House. And as you know, President Obama is a science geek and also really passionate about real people's involvement in solving. And so your voice was a really important part of our work around bringing together those two pieces. And before we get going, what's really important for people to know about you?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, it's good to see you. And yes, it's been quite a minute since I had an opportunity to talk to you. So thank you for having me on. I am Monica McLemore. I use she and her pronouns. And I am currently a tenured full professor in the Child, Family, and Population Health Nursing Department at the University of Washington. And I am a person, I'm a geeky scientist and a clinical nurse who likes to use population health and public health methods to understand the lived experiences. My work mostly is in Black women and Black people and Black pregnant capable people because I work in reproductive health rights and justice. But recently I've been spending a lot of time looking at premature Black death and really looking at health equity and really trying to understand what kind of future do we want to curate that allows for people to optimize their health, and what health systems and health service providers are necessary in order to be able to do that. So I'm also a really geeky person, but I'm a really goofy person. And I love being a professor.
Okay, stop there. How are you goofy?
How am I goofy? I'm a child of the 80s. Let's start. Okay. First of all, I skipped out of my work life yesterday to go play Spyro the Dragon because the world was way too much. So I had to fire up the PS4. And I'm a gamer. I go to Washington State Fair for the games, the prizes, the rides. You get to hang out with the pigs and the horses because like it's a state fair like that. And you know, I'm a goofy person. Oh, you know, goodness.
We miss you in the Bay. You used to live here.
Don't get me started.
I mean, Seattle's great.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, sure. What do you miss?
The things I miss about the Bay, well, being in Seattle is not that different than being in the Bay Area, right? Still West Coast, still good tech, still cultural organizations and institutions, great sports teams, incredible nature and views. I miss the potential of California, and it really broke my heart. So I actually had a really hard time during the pandemic. And to be very clear, as a public health person, as a nurse, I would lock down again in a minute. But that was emotionally and behaviorally hard on my mental health as an extrovert and somebody who does a lot of community engaged work. That was really hard. But what I learned And what I miss most about the Bay is the potential of California. And what I mean when I say that is, as a state...
You just gave me the shivers, by the way. Maybe it's cold. I don't know. But I...
Well, as a state, we have been a practice space for a lot of innovation, technology, the arts, healthcare. And so I left the University of California, San Francisco, after having been there for 20 years. So I started my PhD in 2002, and I finished it and became a tenured faculty member. And I left in 2022 because I really saw us being more tepid, more reactive. I mean, at that time, you got to remember, you know, Newsom was governor. We have a supermajority of liberal people in our legislature. And the UC10 campus system is a crown jewel. We should have been going on offense, pushing back against the anti-science. We should have gone on offense, really standing behind effective public health interventions like masking, like distancing. We should have doubled down around hybrid and work from home environments, not just because it was convenient, but because we could protect our disabled colleagues and our friends who were otherwise immobile. There were things that I really felt in being progressive that should have been leveraged that was still being very reactive, very tepid, very not wanting to be the bold, risk-taking state that leads the nation around innovation in a lot of different domains. So outside of also being emotionally unhappy and needing to fix that, I was like, okay, well, where else in the world can I go? And so coming to Seattle and coming to Washington State has been a real gift. Very similar in terms of having a supermajority in the legislature, having a very progressive governor, you know, who is in his last session, being with people like Sue Birch, who runs the healthcare authority. I mean, when I finish talking to you, I'm going to go to Olympia and preside over my first meeting as the board chair for the Washington Health Exchange Benefits Board, right? Which is a public-private partnership that came out of the ACA because we're going to try to do something no other state has tried to do. And that is we are going to cover everyone regardless of their documentation status. And we're going to learn a lot of lessons. We're going to learn a lot of lessons on that because I'm the chair.
We'll be talking in right? a year because I mean, California also has ambitions to do that, but
we doing it. We doing it. So for us, you know, being able to lead in the health policy space, it broke my heart when I saw that we were willing to react to federal legislation and needs. And that was the only place we were investing our energy.
You were recently on a JAMA webinar podcast with Kirsten Bibbins-Domingo and others talking about the three data points that are so horrifying around maternal deaths. First, that we trail all industrialized nations. And second, that Black women are impacted 2 to 3 to 4 times as much as white women, and that it's getting worse. So the first thing I want to do is just get you to sort of, as a researcher, explicate the overall rates and trends, and then let's dig into what makes it so deadly for Black women.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about maternal morbidity, mortality, and actually reproductive health rights and justice more broadly. So let me start off by saying maternal deaths worldwide are preventable. And the reason I want to start off saying that is I need more people to believe that, because then the actions that are necessary to prevent those deaths might actually happen, right? It is not a fait accompli that people have to die during pregnancy and childbirth. We actually know how to prevent these things from occurring. And I need more people to believe and understand that. Okay. So knowing that, at the same time, in the United States, we have approximately 4 million births per year. So when we talk about maternal morbidity and mortality, it's really important, in my opinion, to point out three facts. Number one, even though these events are tragic, they're rare. Even though these events are tragic and rare, they're preventable. Even though these events are tragic and rare and preventable, we are not doing the things that are necessary to be able to prevent them. So when we say that Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during pregnancy and childbirth, Native, Indigenous, and Pacific Islander people are 1 to 2 times more likely to die in pregnancy and childbirth than white people, and that is increasing over time. One thing I want the listeners to also understand is we can't blame pregnant people for their deaths, right? So these narratives historically that we've had that people come to pregnancy older and sicker and fatter and all these other things, that's actually not the core reason why people are dying during pregnancy and childbirth. It is not an individual characteristic of pregnant capable people. We are also seeing increasing maternal deaths in white people. In fact, I have had to point out that the pregnancy-related outcomes that we see for white people in the United States aren't even the best that we can get in the world. When you look at the statistics in Norway, when you look at the statistics in Finland, when you look at the statistics in Sweden, white people actually have up to 20 to 30 times improved birth outcomes over white people in the United States, regardless of education, regardless of income, regardless of marital status. So we can actually get better pregnancy-related outcomes that approximate the rest of the world. So when I bring up why is this like this, I also have to say to people, what's different about those countries than what we have in the United States? And the way I explain this to the public is relatively simple. If you have a robust social safety net that addresses the environment and context and needs of pregnant capable people, then you're going to see superior health outcomes. You're either going to pay for it on the front end with a robust social safety net, or you can pay for it on the back end, very expensive healthcare. Like there's no in between on that, right? So such that if you give people the supports that they need to be as healthy as they can be before, during, and after pregnancy, and that includes food and decreased stress and transportation and childcare and all that, like if the environment of care is such that we're willing to invest in good outcomes, then we can get better outcomes. I had a mom who was driving for Lyft and Uber as a gig worker while she was pregnant, and because she needed to help take care of her mother who had breast cancer, and she needed the flexibility of being able to get her mom to her appointments back and forth. Don't you know this person was driving for Lyft and Uber 10 days after an emergency C-section because they didn't have paid family leave and they didn't have paid coverage in the postpartum period? The last thing you should be doing after a C-section is sitting in a car for 8 hours, right? The risk for deep vein thrombosis and other kinds of blood clots that can be fatal that are known to be associated with maternal death, right? So when I have to connect the dots for people around like why we need to address the social determinants of health if we want to see improved health outcomes in pregnancy and childbirth, it's because there's a cascade of decisions that happen that put people at higher risk at a population level that we need to intervene on. This is one of the places where insurance coverage has been shown to be associated with improved outcomes, because that whole cascade of decisions that people have to make reduces harm. So for Black and brown women, again, we are more likely to be underemployed, which means we have less access to employer-sponsored health insurance, which means we will make decisions like being a multiple gig worker, driving for Lyft, Uber, DoorDash, whoever, which puts us in a sedentary situation, which is the worst thing you can be in pregnancy and childbirth, right? So let's connect the dots further up the stream instead of just stopping with the body of the pregnant capable person when we think through these outcomes at a population level. The other sort of side of the coin of this is we have to deal with mistreatment and the interactions in the clinical environment. If we are less likely to believe Black and brown people when they present to us with a symptom profile or a symptom trajectory, if we send them home multiple times, like what happened to Shalon Irving, if we're not listening for the right language, then we're going to miss opportunities to intervene when signs and symptoms of deterioration are occurring.
And maybe pause there for a minute and just talk a little bit about Shalon. Who was she? What happened? And why was it so shocking?
The reason I bring up Shalon Irving, because a lot of us in nursing, public health, clinical health services provision, we knew her and we knew her work. This was a young Black person working at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that was public health trained, actually had two doctorates, right, or two master's degrees and a doctorate, who was working on this very issue of maternal morbidity and mortality. And as a Black first-time mom who had a well-controlled underlying condition, had a uneventful pregnancy, had her birth, and in the postpartum period, which is exactly where most maternal deaths occur in the United States and worldwide, went multiple times to go see her clinical team, complaining of what we now know in retrospect are signs and symptoms of preeclampsia and sepsis, right? But nobody listened to her. Nobody believed her. She went to the emergency department several times. This was well documented. There were places where we could have actually intervened to save her life. And she died, right? 10 days after her C-section. I had opportunity to meet Wanda Irving and her daughter Soleil at the Birthing Cultural Rigors Obstetric Patient Safety Summit in December in Nashville. Shalom Irving was the pinnacle of the kind of person that we should be able to keep alive during pregnancy and childbirth. Well-educated, government-funded health insurance, was a government employee and a member of the public health service, right? Advanced education, good social support, and she still died. So when we think about this, or you know, similarly looking at factor V Leiden and other clotting disorder, when you look at somebody like Serena, you're a millionaire. Right? You are a 22-time Grand Slam champion worldwide, and you have to beg your clinical team to listen to you around knowing that you have a pulmonary embolus or blood clot in the lung that you've had before. And it's your job as a internationally recognized, world-renowned athlete to know your body and to be able to operationalize it, to do the incredible things that you do. Think about that. Arrogance of that clinical team to not listen to a person like that, right? If anybody's going to know their body, it's going to be Serena Williams, right? So to me, it's that humility that we need to teach our workforce. It is those structural redundancies that we need to put into place. Who else could have been brought in that would have listened to her, right? There are ways that we have to restructure health services provisions such that one person does not get to determine a trajectory for someone where we're missing deteriorations in those signs and those symptoms, where we're not in conflict with each other, the family, or the patients. When you think about Kira Johnson, right? You think about Charles Johnson's wife for Moms for Kira, as another Black woman who died, educated, world traveled, partnered, family members, right? At one of the best hospitals in the United States, and she still died. So the reason that Black and brown people are more likely to die during pregnancy and childbirth, it doesn't have to do with anything clinically wrong with Black people, right? It actually really has to do with the constellation and the environments in which we are seeking care. Our research with the Birthplace Lab showed that 1 in 6 people, regardless of race and ethnicity in the United States, have reported some kind of mistreatment in their healthcare seeking experiences. And as a nurse, I know this is true. So I believe the statistics when, regardless of race and ethnicity, 1 in 6 pregnant capable people report some kind of violation of privacy, being misspoken to, not being listened to, not being heard, having treatment withdrawn from them or withheld from them, not having call lights being answered. Like, these are all things that are structural. It's not about any one individual. It's about teams being in conflict. It's about us not centering the person that we should all have our eyes on. So for me, it's a lot to think about maternal morbidity and mortality in the United States, which gets us to this idea of, I cannot believe we are sitting here in January and the momnibus has not become the law of the land. It has been introduced 4 times. So for the listeners who don't know what that is, the Black Maternal Caucus, which is a bipartisan group of people in our Congress and in our Senate, have come together to say moms and babies and pregnant capable people matter in the United States. So therefore, we want our policies to reflect this preventative aspect of having people die during pregnancy and childbirth. It started off as 9 bills. It now is 12. Really addressing many of the things that we in public health in clinical health services provision and in policy and in research know are necessary to prevent and improve health outcomes. Everything from improving better data to working around behavior and mental health services for pregnant capable people. Because in some states and in some populations, homicide is the number one cause of pregnancy-related death, being killed by another person, right? If we can't keep the healthiest people, where the number one reason you come into hospitals and healthcare institutions is pregnancy and childbirth, if we can't keep them safe, then that says something about the quality of our healthcare infrastructure and our public health infrastructure. So why do we harp on this? It is because it is an indicator of our moral stance to care for each other. And I need more healthcare people to be able to say that.
Let's go back to the Momnibus, because I think people who have listened so far believe you that this is preventable. So what are some of the aspects of the Momnibus that would be the most critical to get in place over the next couple of years?
So getting postpartum coverage and really being able to look at the data that were necessary around that. I mean, I'm glad to see that we have that intervention happening at the state level, but collecting good data around that is part of Momnibus. Paid family leave and pilot money in HRSA for the perinatal workforce to really understand doulas and midwives and physicians and anesthesiologists and all nurses and all the team, you know, social and behavioral health. All the team that's required, funding the perinatal team within HRSA and CMS to make sure that we have the right constellation of caregivers around people so that we can assist them in meeting their reproductive health goals. That's an essential component of the Momnibus. There are so many provisions within the Momnibus that I think tie together not just the data and the clinical health services needs and the workforce issues that are required to create a policy agenda that would bring us closer to improved health outcomes. It's not even just about the outcome of birth. We know we can get to obesity reduction. We know that we can get to better diabetes and hypertension control. These are things that we know. So for me, it has been a tragedy that people who came together to support a policy agenda to prevent these things are now being gummed up in a larger political game, not of their own making, but of the polarized extremes that we can't even complete the essential function, which is to focus on the people that we serve. So one other aspect I want to bring up about the Momnibus that I also think is really important is it acknowledges both the federal role and the state roles. And financially and human and money and space and time and reputationally aligning us all together. I would also argue we need to listen to actual living people because we can learn from Black people who survived those things. We don't even have our eye on morbidity, right? Mortality is death. Morbidity is like disease and other kinds of incapacities associated with, but you live, but you've got some other thing that has happened. And we need to better take care of those people as well, because having a traumatic birth, yay, you lived, your baby lived, but then you have all these mental health sequelae that are associated with that. Then we need to do something around the other adult involved in the pregnancy, whether it's men's health and dad's health or you know, whoever that spouse or that partner or that grandparent or whoever is helping that constellation of people around children. We need better supports for them as well.
You touched on this earlier, but I want to dig a little deeper because you've talked about jobs as being this uninvited, unwelcome opportunity to reimagine. Similarly, you've talked about COVID being a portal and these moments of disruption where bad things happen, but also we can rearrange the structures in new and better ways. So talk a little bit about that, these kind of these disruptive periods in time, and how can we really, as much as we don't want them to happen, take advantage of them to make change?
Right. I learned, like many people learned during COVID, that there were parts of my life that were being sustained by the busyness of life. Like I say this all the time, who knew that my personal relationships were being held together by my travel?
Let's say more about that.
Well, like, okay, so I am generally on between 100 and 130 flights every year, and there's only 365 days in a year. But if you're not home, I think a lot of people discover during lockdown, that was the longest time I had ever been home in my adult life. So the 15 months that we had lockdown, that was the most consecutive days, months that I had been home. And so when you live with friends, family, whatever it is, right? Travel was saving many of my relationships because I know people across the country and all of a sudden I couldn't see people. I was hosting Zoom calls on Tuesday nights just to be around other humans because otherwise there was a cadence of being able to see them in person. Similarly, on a more personal note, I had never spent that much time with my partner at that time, right? And so travel really allowed for me to be able to always feel grateful when I got home and, you know, have a whole different dynamic. But when you're in a house with somebody for 15 months, that's a whole different thing, right? So COVID, Dobbs, George Floyd's murder, there's a whole lot of like catalytic events that have occurred that are negatively focused that really give us an opportunity to think about public health infrastructure as well as clinical health services provision. I like to remind people, whether we wanted to or not, we figured out a way to get a basic minimum income to our citizens during COVID. I like to remind people that the hybrid world in which it can be convenient for many was possible. That we got restrictions removed around medication abortion that we knew weren't scientifically accurate. Or that we were able to have telehealth be elevated. How many people worked on telehealth before COVID for decades trying to get parity and payment? And all of a sudden that was a thing. And we're amassing a set of data that showed that for some patients, that is preferred, especially if you got to get childcare and transportation, or you have to worry about, you know, racist interactions or disrespectful interactions when you go into a healthcare system or waiting forever in a waiting room, right? I mean, so there were innovations that got spawned by these really negative things. And I want us to think about not just policy, but clinical service provision and public health. What are those other opportunities that we have? For me, it taught me a whole new way to be community engaged, and it made me redefine what community meant. It made me use the social media tools and other tools that the people that we serve are using to talk directly to the public. COVID, Dobbs, you know, George Floyd's murder, that tore down a lot of firewalls that existed. It removed a lot of gatekeeping, right? That existed that I don't think people had a huge appreciation for. So to me, when I think about reproductive health rights and justice, we have a prime opportunity to rethink what we would want to protect people with capacity for pregnancy. Because then we would rearrange our resources very differently if we just looked at pregnancy in and of itself and what are the successful things that help us to get those improved and incredible outcomes. Right? Worldwide, we know that in different places, right? We know facility-based birth in global spaces improves that safety. Well, that's not the problem we have here in the United States. In fact, we have too much facility-based birth, right? Too much intervention. So, and we have clinical learners and trainees who have lost their skills. Everybody talks about midwives and doulas. One of the reasons why we talk about midwives and doulas is because I know a lot of nurses and physicians that can look at a computer and read a strip, but they can't sit on the bedside, look at somebody's mama in the eye, hold a person's hand and be like, this is okay, we got this, right? People have lost skills. So when we think about the teams that are required to safely shepherd people through whatever reproductive outcome they have, that's what COVID and that's what Dobbs and that's what George Floyd's murder has allowed us the opportunity to pan all the way back, move away from outcomes-driven research and to look at the natural history and the basic science of the phenomena we really want to study, which is looking at pregnancy, how people make pregnancy decisions.
You've touched on the way you do research and the concept of really centering people in clinical services is also the way you go about learning through your research. And I'd just love to have you describe for our listeners, what does a community-centered research approach look like? And how is that fundamentally different from the traditional ways that we've thought about research?
I appreciate this question about community-centered research because I'm at a point in my career where my community partners are now telling me what research needs to be done. As a bench scientist, as a researcher, as a public health person, as a nurse, I have been taught to review the literature and think about research questions that I think would be valuable in the world as an individual, right? That time of science being a single stage, sage on the stage with a great idea, trying to get a Nobel and win prizes and change the world, that's done. What we need, and the reason I'm now a community-led researcher, I have people who come to me with ideas, right? So the Black Girl's Guide to Menopause came to me and was like, we need to have more genderqueer and binary people and non-binary people and folks in our menopausal trajectory, because many of those folks, especially those who are receiving gender-affirming services and care, they're having to make these decisions around chemical menopause versus not. So community-engaged research, which is how I started, was really a response, a reactive stance to Black people aren't being listened to, we're not being heard, and we're asking the wrong research questions. So when I started, the language I would use is, okay, I want to be a community-engaged researcher, which means I'm going to engage at some level, whether it's asking for their input, asking for their feedback once we completed a study. That, to me, was engagement. But that was a reactive stance to being excluded. So that was like a retrofit to the scientific enterprise. Oh, we're going to include community engagement because historically they've been excluded. We're asking the wrong questions. Our questions get better when we include community members, so let's retrofit. But then there was a reformation. Like I then moved to community co-designed research, meaning that I would partner with them to figure out what research questions around a specific domain needed to be asked and answered, and how could we work together to do that, right? So that's where we started research prioritization. Hearing from community members what research questions they have, we would rank and generate and prioritize research questions. And then I would bring my questions because I'm a member of the community, and then my team would bring their questions. That to me really became community co-designed or co-led research. Now I'm at, I follow community. People come to me with research projects and they're like, we need to do this, Monica, but we need your help because we're not researchers. So I'm at a point now in my career where community members come to me, they recognize me as a researcher who can be an ethical partner, who can admit when I'm wrong, I can transfer resources to people, I can connect them to resources, and I'm supporting a lot of learners, a lot of students. So I'm at a point where I'm behind the scenes doing nursing, right? Because that's the other thing, right? Nurses, when we do our work well in hospitals and healthcare institutions, our work is invisible. Because, right? So, and that's because we're connecting, we're bringing pharmacy in, we're making sure the orders have been transferred. Like good nursing work is like watching an Olympic gymnast. You don't see all the years of injury and training and all this other stuff. What you see is the execution. So I'm now doing that for the entire field of science, and where public health and clinical health services provision collides, in my opinion, is community-led work. There is no way we're going to get at changes in health outcomes at a population level if you don't bring the social and the clinical together. It's just not happening. And so that requires a change in mindset of the scientific community about what is evidence, who generates evidence, who can contribute to evidence, what evidence is needed, and what methods are we going to use to obtain said evidence. Because community is over extraction. They are over participating in studies and not getting anything back. They are over funding science as taxpayers and not being able to access it. For me, when I do community engaged work and I do community led work and community fostered work, I am trying to show that this is a new method that we need to be using, because those other methods are not helpful. They're not going to get us to what we want and what we need. Because you can't study social processes using laboratory methods. You just can't. And I wouldn't want to.
We are getting to the final part of the conversation, and this is where I ask for your advice.
Yes.
So I, as you mentioned earlier, just last week, last Tuesday, assumed a new role as the Chief Social Impact Officer at Berkeley School of Public Health. So I want to start with kind of a broader question, which is, with all the context that you've laid out, what are the opportunities for schools of public health across the United States and at Berkeley to create more thriving and health in the world?
Well, the first thing I would do is listen. There has to be a series of listening sessions, opportunities for community to plug in. And when I say listen, I don't just mean like focus groups, right? Y'all, somebody's got to have some TikTok presence or YouTube, some kind of social media thing, because the future of public health 20, 50 years down the line, they in high school and haven't been born yet, right? So those tools have to be used in perpetuity to help us really have a constant feedback loop, because public health is not anything without the public. And people get mad when I say that, but the truth of the matter is public health is not anything without the public. Okay. Number two, the other thing that schools of public health should be doing is if there is not, and I know this is true at Berkeley, where you have a very strong relationship with the Department of Public Health, but for those practitioners who are not part of the school, where public health gets operationalized, schools of public health need to have a relationship with them and not just to place students for practical things, right? One thing I'm working on right now is co-funding a position within DOH and at the University of Washington, because there's such alignment and overlap for our Pathways to the Health Professions program, that there's no reason that DOH should exclusively fund that when we have work on our side that we can help have this person help us to do as well. So identifying the places for synergy and overlap, and then thinking about the opportunities to co-fund activities, people, and projects, I think is also going to help institutionalize or concretize what you're trying to do, right? And then the third thing I think is social impact also has to have continuous accountability. So that means convening the community-based organizations, even if historically they've been harmed, because in some places folk won't need to have an apology, and that's as good as it's going to get, because nobody wants to work with people who have historically harmed them. And I need more of that kind of truth and reconciliation. There's some great work that Dean Zayton and Hopkins is working on right now. But there are institutions that have been historically harmful to the public. And there's some that needs to be acknowledged. And that needs to be ritualized. Even at my own institution, at my own school, there was an apology to Black nurses because our founding dean would not allow for Black nurses to come to our school. We renamed our largest endowed professorship, as well as the lectureship that goes along with that, to the endowed professorship in health promotion from that dean's former name with the support of the regents. There's some truth and reconciliation and harm repair that needs to happen. And that's where it's going to end. And that's okay. Because that in and of itself is a potential for those future people to be able to come back to those folks and be able to do work. But we need a long strategy, and then you need a short one. And the short one is start with listening. Then it's partnering with our departments of public health. Just because they've been decimated and just because they've been maligned and just because they have been harmed doesn't mean that they're not important, that they don't serve a crucial role, and that we need to double down around their importance. And using the institutional legitimacy of our organizations is one way to do that. So for me, those are the three things off the top of my head that I would think about in terms of what you should be doing and what you could be doing. You know, a lot of people we know and love have done this work cyclically. I think about Nina Wallerston in at University of New Mexico. There are public health deans that are really trying to do this. Sal Galeo in Boston, there are some folk there. Maybe you need an advisory committee of some deans of school of public health to also help you think about what are the challenges and the opportunities that you currently have to think through how to put a strong foundation in so that 20, 30, 50 years from now, you know, we have the clinical and public health infrastructure that the people we serve really deserve.
in every organization I join, I try to think really hard about what are the offers? Like, what is the particular power of this place? And, you know, in universities, it's very tempting to say it's research, it's education. Those are true. But also universities are platforms for change and have a credibility to be the holders of conversations, of hard conversations.
Yeah.
But that needs to be cultivated. That doesn't have, that's not handed to you because you're a university.
Right.
That's cultivated
right.
through practice and, right. and through connection and through relationship and through networks and through what you write and what you say and truth telling.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, and there's sort of a boldness in that. You talked earlier about the sadness you had about California not moving in more boldness. And I think universities haven't always been bold, but they have such a huge opportunity to be bold.
Yeah. I appreciate you letting me be on this and getting a chance to see you. And let me know how I can, if and how I can support your work at Berkeley.
I would love to have a separate, and I know your schedule's crazy, but let's see if we can find time for a separate schedule.
If I can help you, I would love to do that.
I think you can tell how passionate, opinionated, and incredibly wise Dr. McLemore is. I listened really hard to the advice she gave about how schools of public health can increase their positive impact in the world. That topic is really personal for me, since I just took a role as Chief Social Impact Officer at Berkeley School of Public Health. Here's what she says. First, we need to listen and engage on the platforms like TikTok and YouTube that young people use. Then we need to build strong partnerships and relationships with local and state health departments. Finally, to build trust with local communities, we'll need to acknowledge past harms. This podcast was created by me, Claudia Williams. My podcast producer is Avery Moore-Kloss. Check out the show notes for more information about Monica McLemore and her research on maternal health. There is more information on my background, this podcast, and our guests on our website, www.theother80.com. Until next time, I'm Claudia Williams.